Back to class. Afternoon session is begun, has begun. Comments and questions before we move on. Okay, well, this first session in the afternoon, we're going to be dealing with our theme of the light of inspiration, this time in terms of words. We've talked about music and art and literature. Now we're going to talk about words by themselves, not in the form of literature. We know from our esoteric studies that words embody power, that correctly spoken, certain words can have a magical impact on the world around us. Alice Bailey indicates that many of these words were widely known during Atlantean times, and that it was the abuse of these words for selfish gain that brought down that great civilization. After that, the words were quietly withdrawn from usage, and yet words still possess the power to lift heavy blocks of stone to build pyramids or to tear down the walls of Jericho. We know that from our ancient scriptures. It is for humanity's protection that we no longer recognize this latent power of words or are able to apply it. Still, when Ronald Reagan said, "Tear down that wall," his words led to the wall being torn down a few years later. So words have that power. Words can be used to bless. Words can be used to curse. Winston Churchill's ability to rally the British people to withstand the Nazi onslaught was a sign of his ability to marshal the power of words to evoke the essence of being a Briton. He spoke the language of victory, not the idiom of defeat. This is why I stress researching the etymology of the words you use. It's a key to their power. Take the word slave. Does anyone know the etymological roots of the word? Slave. Anybody? Anybody got a guess as to the meaning of the word slave? Nobody? You should have been able to look it up by now.
Is it slave or slave?
Slave, S-L-A-V-E. Uh-huh. And here's Nancy communicating by iChat, and she's correct. It refers to Slav, as in Yugoslavian. And the idea here is that many, at a certain point, many Slavs were sold into slavery when the Slavic nations were overrun. So a slave is a Slav, because it was so common that they ended up as slaves. Anyway, slavery is a very old idea. Freedom is a very young idea. Humanity is still learning what it means, but the sense of slavery is to be the property of someone else. And in order to, what that means is that if you let anybody dominate your mind, you're a slave. It's not just at the physical level, it's emotionally and mentally. If you are controlled by somebody else emotionally, you're a slave. If you're controlled mentally, you're a slave. And so you can see that many people in the political arena want to reinstitute slavery, at least at the mental level, if not at all levels, in the name of freedom. So etymologically, what is the root of the word liberal? Liberal. What is the root of the word liberal?
Say liberty or something.
This, yes, Rose has it. It's the same as liberty or liberate. A liberal is one that believes in liberty. A liberal is one that believes in liberality, the freedom to think, the freedom to speak. And of course, the word has been completely corrupted now to mean exactly the opposite. And so a liberal is one that cherishes human freedom and is opposed to slavery. The word originally grew up meaning liberation from monarchy. But you can understand that these words have great power. And I consider myself to be a liberal in the true sense of the word, but not in the current usage of the word.
Now, before you used freedom to, these definitions are freedom from.
A lot of the usage of freedom is freedom from, but it mm-hmm. should be freedom to make a choice. Mm-hmm. What, are you looking at freedom?
No, it's under liberty.
Oh.
It's freedom from
freedom
arbitrary
from tyranny, freedom
or despotic
from, yeah.
government, freedom from external or foreign rule, freedom from control, interference, obligation, blah, blah, blah. Freedom from captivity.
Okay. Well, you make a good point that freedom is something that stands alone. The moment you say, I'm free of so-and-so's mental tyranny, you're not free because you're still thinking terms
of
that.
Attaching
the atheist that denies God, as I've said, walking oxymoron, a walking antithesis. Because the moment you say, I don't believe in God, you've just said, I believe in God. Because how can you not believe in something that doesn't exist? So by admitting that it exists, but you don't believe in it, you have shot yourself in the foot big time. Or Bigfoot. How about the word human? See, we're doing this to track the power of ideas. What's the root of the word human? I'm listening.
Homo sapiens human.
No, it's not homo.
No, I'm just reading what it says.
Homo pertaining to man.
Man.
No, that's the meaning, it's not the root. There's no power in that concept. That's an idea, that's a meaning, it's not the power.
Humane.
The root.
Knowing man.
Knowing man, no.
What about
human? There you go. It's a Middle Eastern dish made out of chickpea. No, that's hummus. Humus, the earth, dirt, dust. We are a race made out of clay, and to clay we return. You didn't ever know that was more than just a clever idea, did you? That biblical statement is a statement of power because it is based on the root of the word humanity, clay. We are clay. But there's a deeper meaning as well. Our purpose for being here on earth is to redeem the substance of earth. We are made out of clay in order to redeem clay, figuratively speaking, which literally means we are made out of the material, astral, or mental substance of earth, so that we can redeem form at all levels, matter, substance. It's right there in our name, humanity. We are of the earth in order to spiritualize it. So our purpose and our sacrifice are imprinted in the very word human. Now, we are told in the Bible that Adam was the first man. His name in Hebrew means round. Adam, The divine comes to earth to lift up the earth and make it divine. See how much power is contained in the simple words that we use every day without any sense of meaning or depth. It's written right in our very name, humanity, and Adam. The clue to, this puts the idea of the fall of Adam and Eve into a completely different light, because the name Adam, which precedes the fall, predicted the fall. He had to go to earth. He had to descend under earth and become of earth and humbled like earth, lower than dirt, in order to do his work. That's right in this very concept, conception as mankind, had by God. So the clue to almost any quality of aspect of human life can be found in a study of the word's roots. In Walden Grove, we won't have spelling bees, we'll have root bees, or root beers, or something. But we'll have spelling bees that include not only spelling, but meaning and the root of the word. So it won't be just enough to know that humanity is spelled H-U-M-A-N-I-T-Y. We'll have to define what that means and what the root is. That's an art that is almost entirely... I never learned how to look up etymologies or the importance of etymology anywhere in elementary, high school, or college. That's self-taught. I had a revelation one day on the road to Damascus. So while you're sitting there at your computers, assuming you are, you can use your computers to look up the roots of words. All you have to do is go to type in etymology on the Google line, and it'll bring up the online dictionary of etymology. So what's the, let's look up the roots of the word art, A-R-T, as in fine arts, not as in terms of thou art good, but art.
A work of art, practical skill.
Okay, yeah. Business. Skill is bringing it in. A work of skill is part of the original meaning. Did anybody, how far back does the word go? You mean to say there wasn't any art before 1886?
I'm scrolling down. 1610.
Dorothy?
10th century.
Oh, that's yesterday.
Yeah.
The key is to look for the letters I-E or P-I-E, and that's a reference to Indo-European. That's a fancy academic term for Sensar, the language of Atlantis. Now, they don't know that, they don't accept the fact that there was an Atlantis, let alone a language, but Indo-European is the root of all Latinate languages and Hindu and all kinds of stuff, Farsi. And it was introduced into the European continent at about 14,000 years ago, just right after the fall of Atlantis. And it migrated from northern Europe over into the Himalayas in India. And it is indeed the root of Sanskrit as well as the Latinate languages. And so anytime you see IE or Indo-European or PIE, I don't know what the P stands for, maybe Judy does. What?
Proto-Indo-European.
Is that kind of like prebiotic, proto?
I asked Donna that. She's the one in medicine.
Oh.
I don't know.
All right. Well, anyway, in the Indo-European root here of art is something that's made with skill, a product of human invention. But it also has the sense of the culmination of learning and the ability to put things together. So that's art. It was only recently, fairly recently, a few hundred years ago, that it became synonymous with the fine arts. That's why liberal arts, as in liberal arts education, is a reference more to academic studies and accumulated learning than it is to the skills of art or music or whatever. That's the thou art. Okay, so we've taken care of art. We've discovered that the root of art is skill. How about science? Science?
To cut or divide?
Very good, very good. Again, what's the roots? Indo-European. You're going to find that almost every word I throw at you today is going to be Indo-European. And it's amazing how Judy, who has studied linguistics, can attest to the fact that 40, 50 years ago, well, more than that, but 100 or so years ago, nobody knew about Indo-European. But it has, they've discovered that it is the genuine root of most of our language in any language. Whether we're talking European or Arabic or Hindu, all these languages sprout out from the Indo-European, which is Sensar, the language of Atlantis. So, yes. Yeah, that's kind of old fashioned. It does the modern use in English and other languages does derive from the Latin, but the Latin derived from the Indo-European. And that's where you come up with the idea of cut and divide. The way to interpret that is that it basically means to know by analysis. So to know by analysis as opposed to know by revelation. There is knowing by revelation. There's knowing by taking something and smashing it apart and analyzing its components. That's science. Right. That, of course, is synthesis. The intuition synthesizes, the intellect analyzes and divides. The intellect measures the and defines the parts. The intuition synthesizes and shows the common meaning or power. Science is largely devoid of synthesis or intuition, except in its brilliant people like Einstein and Niels Bohr and so on. All right, here's a word for you. School, S-E-H-O-O-L, school. This one may surprise you.
not the PIE.
Yeah.
It's to hold in one's power to have.
Okay. There's some other more distant variations on the theme.
Before 900, Middle English skulls.
Sounds like a toast with liquor.
S-C-O-L-E.
Skull.
There's French E-S-C-O-L-E.
Also Latin scola.
Yeah, that's the same root as scholastic. Yeah. Okay.
Leisure.
Yeah, very good. In the Greek, when you get back to the Greek, it is the term refers to leisure, a place where lectures are given, which is the original meaning of academy too. It was the grove where Plato lectured. So, in the Greek sense, a school, and of course, our whole Western tradition of schooling is based on this, was a place for leisurely reflection and learning, thinking. And that's completely at odds with our current conception. We just started school down here a week ago, and they were showing pictures, of course, on the news channel, the evening news, of these poor little 7-year-olds carrying a 40-pound knapsack of books as they trot off to school, where, of course, they're going to be forced to read these books of drivel, and they're going to be immediately forced to do this at double time, as though they're in the military. Yes, this is a blessing for chiropractors. And yet the very root of the word school should be a place of leisure for leisurely exploration and reflection. And of course, one of our concepts of leisure in our modern era is that we have fun in leisure. Leisure time is when we have fun. The rest of the time is when we work. And then, of course, there's also sleep. So, the Greeks knew that in order to learn something, you had to approach it leisurely and thoughtfully. There was not a time for regimented, enforced instruction, pedagogy.
Come on, kitty.
So a school, it should be a place of leisure. And that's something that I would emphasize as we move towards creating Walden Grove schools.
Okay, you want to come in?
Next word, opinion. Or opine, if you wish. Opinion. Anybody got an opinion?
To choose.
There you go. Again, it's in the European, isn't it?
Yes.
So an opinion is a choice, as in, I choose to believe this, but disbelieve that. Doesn't sound very intelligent to me, does it? Does it to you? What I'm reminded of is, I wrote a column on this not too long ago. We were watching the evening news on Fox, the special report, and Mort Kondracki was on the panel, and he was talking about something. He says, I refuse to believe that blah, 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 whatever it was. And I can't think of that's almost the equivalent of putting a sign on your back or your forehead saying, stupid, kick me. I refuse to believe. What does that mean? It means nothing.
It means I'm totally emotional. I'm completely governed by my emotions on this subject. I don't give a fig what the truth is. I refuse to believe what you just said. And when you take it apart, it's kind of insulting. He probably was saying it after listening to Charles Krauthammer or something. He's, well, I refuse to believe that. And, you know, all right, here I've got a sandbox, stick your head in it. It's, but of course, the opposite of that, I choose to believe, is equally dumb. Why are we believing at all? If we're thinking, we should be understanding, not believing. Anyway, that's just my opinion. Next word. We're looking for the power of these words. You can see how corrupted we, I mean, there are key words that we have, the left has really worked over, and the dark forces, not necessarily the same thing, but people have worked really hard to corrupt the meaning of, because that diminishes their power. Growth. Growth. This one's fascinating to me. Anybody? Okay, Nancy has think. Or was that opinion?
That was opinion.
That must have been opinion.
That was opinion.
Okay, Nancy changes that to no. All right. All right, well, we're on to growth.
I saw something that says to be exit.
To be what?
Exit. E-X-I-S-T.
Oh.
But it's in regard to physics and science.
Oh.
But it is a Indo-European base.
Okay. Have you?
The other one is, I think, the natural things.
Like what?
It's just, let's see. It's the name of Aristotle's treatise on nature.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a hint, but anybody come up with anything else as a root? And I say root advisedly.
There's just a
something from the Old Norse, G-R-O-T-H-R.
Okay, well, you got to go further back than that. That derives from Indo-European, too. In the Indo-European, the word was grass. The meaning of the word growth was, that's what the grass does. It grows. And then you mow it down. But the interesting thing here is that while the word for growth is grass, if we know how grass grows, it grows by photosynthesis. It absorbs the sun, and it draws the water out of the earth, and it takes those and combines them and produces growth. So even in the Indo-European root, and that's why I was laughing about root, is the word is grass, which has roots. This is a symbol for thinking. We take the light of the sun and the soil of the earth and the water, and we combine them in photosynthesis, thinking, and we convert them into something new and better, which helps us grow. How about that? Now, is that a model for presenting to young thinkers that want to understand life or not? I think it's great. The simple process of grass right there in front of us, and we missed its point. Here's one. Excellence.
on here in the dictionary.
No problem. No.
That's what came on here as free.
Anybody on excellence? Judy, you should be right in on top of this one.
Do you have a dictionary over here?
I say that.
What? Well, you often talk about excellence. And you love words.
I do love words, and I was just thinking, I was wondering if it had to do with cell air for speed.
Oh, XL, XL?
I can look it up.
Okay. Okay. Well, the Indo-European root of this is to elevate, like levitate, to lift up, to make it the highest. So excellence is the highest. And you can't elevate any higher than that. So excellence should be the end result of growth, because growth elevates you. Yeah, that was good. Next word, worth. W-O-R-T-H, worth. Worth?
To turn?
Yes, now isn't that interesting, to turn, from the Indo-European turning. And if you put a simple little syllable in front of that return, then you get the idea that something is worth what it will return. In other words, the value of anything is not just what it is inherently worth, but what the return will be, like gold has now reached $1,700 an ounce, and people who buy gold today are buying it not with the expectation of getting $1,700 out of it per ounce, but in a few weeks getting $2,000 an ounce out of it. The return. The turn. It's in the context of Poe's Eureka. You send out from the hub to the periphery, and then it returns, and it brings back added experience and value. We should have value-added thinking. We send a thought out, it works, it comes back and brings us new value. And the interesting thing here is that this is the power of this is the concept of profit. We make investments in human life for profit. Now, we can do that in a commercial sense, but, for example, you're taking this class in order to learn certain things that will profit you and help you. And so you're looking, the worth of this to you is how much you learn. That's your profit. That's the return on your effort. And this implies balance. One of the synonyms for turn that Dorothy came up with when I looked it up was versus. That we sally forth and we make an investment and or we try to promote an idea and people attack us, but in the process of attacking it, they make the idea and the value of what we're proposing more dear, and we make it more useful in the revision, and therefore we increase its worth. One notion here would be in writing, we write a draft, and then we set it aside, and then a few days later we edit it. The edit is like the return, and that increases the worth of what we've written. So worth is based on what we can get back from something. Anything we invest in life, anything we share with others, any support that we give, the value to us is what we get back out of it. Not necessarily in a selfish way, but this is a fundamental principle of creation. God emanates the creation and expects to get a
return on his efforts.
So then part of it is enrichment.
Enrichment, absolutely. Okay, here's another word. Triumph. And it has nothing to do with being a little uncomfortable car. Triumph? Anybody? This one is, Triumph only goes back as far as the Greek, where it was a hymn to Bacchus. After you went out and slew your opponents or whatever, you came back and you sang a hymn to Bacchus, and that was triumph. So an Arc de Triomphe or whatever, this is the celebration of your victory, of your achievement.
That's like the Willie Nelson Toby Keith song. And
Beer for my horses, exactly.
I mean, that's what it reminds me of. You know, that after all the battle's done, how does it go?
Well, you go out and you clean the streets up of all the bad guys. You string them up so they can meet their maker, and then you go back to the tavern and you have whiskey for my men, beer for my horses. Yes. Right. Yes. It's a hymn to Bacchus, the god of wine, or in this case, whiskey or beer. Excellent. Very good. Then we have the word sense, S-E-N-S-E, sense. This one may surprise you, so this is such an ordinary word, sense.
I found to go.
To go, all right. As in you go, huh? well, again, the Indo-European root loosely translated is to find one's way, or to go. And the usage in the sense that we're aware of, the five senses of touch and so on, is fairly recent, only in the last few hundred years. There is a biblical context, and that is to apprehend meaning. And so the ancient meaning of sense is revelation. You sense an insight. You get a hunch. That's a sense. You find your way through a mental maze. You sense your way. You grope your way through the darkness. This is the penetration of darkness to meaning. You make sense out of life. That's synthesis. And so, like I say, science has now postulated the five senses. But that is a very, very narrow interpretation of it. And, of course, they would have the doubting Thomas of science would say, well, if I can't touch it, smell it, see it, or hear it, it doesn't exist. Well, these are senseless people. That's all I can say about it. Here's an interesting one. Nothing. Nothing. Zip zero. Nothing. I'll give you a hint on this. This is a two-step one because there's nothing under nothing. There's no root. But it is, the word is formed as a compound of no thing. So if you want to understand nothing, you have to look up thing. Just thought I'd give you a hint.
Stretch?
Well, yeah, that's a stretch. No, I'm sorry. Stretch is involved in it. There's no question about it. And out of that, some people have concluded that the word stretch means not in an elastic sense, but in a span of time. During a certain stretch of time, this can occur. And the actual original meaning in Indo-European seems to be a set time for a meeting. For example, we're doing our thing today from 9 to 5. That's a stretch of time. So a thing in European, Indo-European, in Sensar, was an appointed time to get together and assemble. And a no thing is something that is the negation of a time to meet. Yes.
Carl?
Yes.
In Iceland, back in 900-something, they had a king, and it was when all of the 13 tribes came together once a year for a few weeks.
Right.
And actually had a democratic decision-making body, kind of the oldest genuine democracy in Europe. And it was considered to be like the oldest government that would be an antecedent to what we have here. And it went for years, and it was phenomenal. They have they had a speaker each year that was in charge of deciding all of the laws that had ever been decided among all the troops every year that they had existed.
Right. And
so, anyway, it's called the King.
If you
King Valley is like the most sacred place in the whole country.
Right. And if you remember in the Dave Duncan A Man of His Word series, there is a group of Viking-like people that meet for that same kind of thing. And so our use of the word thing is, any old thing. It's an unspecified object that we can't define any other way. We call it a thing. But, yeah. The actual idea here is that it is this, as Judy explained, this meeting. And what we can conclude is, based on that testimony, if this is the oldest or one of the older forms of democracy in action, that liberalism stands for no thing, nothing. Anyway, to contrast that, how about the word all? A-W-A-L-L, all.
Carl, it's no thing. Can I just ask you, if no thing, then would that maybe be a description of chaos?
Pretty much, I think so.
I mean, it just seemed like, yeah. That's interesting. I just thought that might apply.
Yes, I think that's a very productive line of thinking. That whenever we talk about nothing, we're talking about the impossible. Because how can you have no thing? If a thing has any meaning at all, nothing, I mean, you can't do nothing. You can call your friend up and say, let's do lunch. But you never call them up and say, let's do nothing.
Well, it's like the God, what you were saying, but I don't believe in God. Great,
yeah,
argument.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the word itself exposes its utter lack of meaning. Okay, anything on all, A-L-L? I'm running over time here a little bit, but I want to finish my list.
Okay.
Anybody? All? A-L-L? I don't need all the definitions. Well, this one's pretty easy. It comes from the Germanic, and it simply means entire, complete, everything there is. To me, the interesting thing about this is that the meaning of the word all can't apply to a finite collection. It has to apply to infinity. Since it, in definition, is complete, nothing in the physical plane can ever be complete. You could talk about the complete works of William Shakespeare, but how do you know that he didn't leave a few behind that aren't in the complete collection. And in fact,
secret manuscript.
Yeah, secret manuscript. So complete is a word that implies infinity rather than finite.
Carl, also Allah comes from that word.
Oh, really? Well, very good.
The same word.
Excellent. Satisfaction, as in I can't get now. Okay. Right, it's from the Latin, and it basically means to pay a debt. You settle a debt, you satisfy the debt. So satisfaction is not a passive state of being sated, of saying, oh, what a satisfying meal that was, or mediocrity, well, that was satisfactory. It is, you pay a debt. You satisfy your obligations. And in Catholicism, there's a rite of satisfaction where you atone for your sins. Okay, how about two more? Right. R-I-G-H-T. Right.
Move in a straight line?
Yes. Again, an Indo-European route. Move in a straight line. So as long as we're moving toward our goal, and the goal, of course, is divine, we're right. Isn't that easy? And now, wrong. Okay, in what sense?
Let's see. There's something here that says that which distorts the mouth.
Okay, so if something turns sour, it's wrong. Or if something turns away from the straight line and moves in crooked ways, it's wrong. But there's that sense of right and wrong is based on right moves in a straight line directly to the goal. Wrong is anything that takes you off the path.
You're twisted.
Twists things, moves in crooked ways, goes by detour, isn't a straight line. So right and wrong, the power of these concepts is everything that's right is direct, straightforward, simple,
to the point. Wrong is everything that confuses and creates obfuscation. So, the moral of our lesson today is that words have power and should be used to inspire. Use them wisely. Always move in a straight line. Never use words to turn sour. Okay. We're a little over our budget here, but I think that was useful. All right. Let's go on then to our history lesson for the day, which is we've been talking about the evolution of peace. And today I want to talk about what I call the war of ideas. And since we just have been working with words, here's another one. Peace. What's the root of that? Peace. Thought you could put that away, didn't
you?
No, peace. P-E-A-C-E.
A kin to pact?
Well, a pact can be in the sense of agreeing with others, yes.
That's what I said, a peace.
Oh, no, appease pretty much means give in.
Well, but that says it right next to pact.
Okay.
Right. Pact, appease.
I thought something fasten.
Fasten, yes. This is the Indo-European root again, to fasten or secure. So after a war, you go and you have a pact or treaty talks with your opponent, and you agree on boundaries and you create a peace treaty. The establishment of peace is securing the relationships with those around you. And of course, this is double-edged sword, because we have to be at peace with ourselves before we can be at peace with others. And that's true nationally. We can be at peace within ourselves, even though we may not be at peace with all nations. But are we truly at peace with ourselves? What is the condition of our social intercourse at emotional and mental levels, naturally and mentally? Now, there's no war at the level of big ideas, just universal concord and agreement. But at concrete mental levels and lower than that at astral levels, this concord disappears rapidly. And there are mighty struggles between contending forces mentally, between capitalism, the ideas of capitalism and the ideas of socialism, between atheism and religion, between permissiveness and prohibitionarianism, between doubt and conviction. And these struggles, the war of ideas, is reflected in the physical plane, of course. And they're reflected in the levels of opinion and belief. And so we have Christian fighting Muslim for about the last 1,000 years. We have Catholics fighting Protestants, not necessarily in warfare, although that happens, but in the war of ideas, argument over theology. And of course, 50 years ago, the Pope announced the great ecumenical movement. And yet Catholicism and Protestantism are still as separate as they ever were. Now, we all know that esoterically, at the roots, all Christian traditions are pretty much the same, and Christianity and Hinduism and all the other religions are one and the same at their roots esoterically, but not in their outer guises. And of course, there's the struggle of Judaism versus almost everyone else. There's the old world versus the new world. There's finite thinking versus infinite thinking. And the good old-fashioned right versus wrong. Our whole culture of debating issues is a form of mental warfare. We train kids in school to beat each other up mentally and emotionally. We pit idea against idea and never bother to resolve the conflict. We think in terms of one side wins and the other loses. Barack Obama won the election. The first thing he did when he met John McCain in a negotiation was to tell him, "You lost, I won." Well, that pretty much sums up everything that's wrong in this country right now. The sneering, arrogant attitude, "You lost, I'm in control now." True thinking leads to a perception of truth. It's not a contest, it's an exploration. Everyone can participate, everyone wins if they make an effort. It's not a contest with winners and losers. How were you taught to think in school? I'd like some discussion. How were you taught to think in school? Were you taught to combat false ideas or to join with people who think differently in a common pursuit of the highest, or what? Were you given any capacity to stand up against false ideas? Anybody, any comments?
Carl, I think the only time I had any instruction of that nature was in religion class. And it was to essentially memorize and then regurgitate catechism.
Okay. And to deny everybody, to deny the truth of everybody else's opinion. Yeah. Right.
But not in a way that was, I don't want to say, obviously it wasn't meaningful, but it was not very deep. It was
superficial.
These are the words that you say. It doesn't matter if you really understand what you're saying or not.
Right. Well, talking points. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. That's exactly what they were. They were really Catholic talking points.
Well,
in the early 70s. And even though, you know, John the 23rd had had the big, whatever it was, in 63 or something, 62, when everything was supposed to change.
Right.
It really didn't change very much in a superficial way of changing, but the catechism that I was taught was still the same catechism that had been taught in the 20 years.
Right. And that Roman Catholic talking points, where did that come from? Came from the Office of Propaganda.
Propaganda, that's right.
The word propaganda is a Catholic word meaning to propagate. But the idea is to propagate the faith, but the price of propagation or propaganda was they burned everybody at the stake that disagreed with them.
Brainwashed us.
Right, and then later on it came to mean we're going to come to your house and get money from you. They used to have these fundraisers. They called it the propagation of faith. And it was basically a call for donation.
Right. Okay.
You know, big
donation. So we're not dumping on Catholics here. Every religion has their own equivalent to this. But this is the milieu in which children grow up trying
desperately somehow to figure out what this thinking is all about. So what are the major battles in the war of ideas today? Feel free to make a contribution.
Makes no sense, you know, when someone says, I love it when people say, they start a comment by saying, well, this might not be true, but this might not be how, you know, this might not be the truth, or this might not be right, and then they go ahead and say it anyway, and
sure.
No one says, well, how come you're saying it?
Well, you touched a very important point. You've touched on a very important point when it comes to Fox News and CNN and all the rest of them. When they have their little round tables with four or five people talking, no one ever confronts another person and says, well, you're just full of crap. Not even politely. They never challenge. If Bob Beckel makes some idiotic statement, which is almost guaranteed. No one else says, well, you know, that's just factually not true. Occasionally, there's... They may disagree with them, but they will usually say, well, let's think about that, blah, 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 and they'll put it in a different way. There's no sincerity in these discussions. It's just... They're waiting for their time. They'll have their airtime. They've been trained not to question what anybody else on the panel says. I don't know that for a fact. It's probably not true, but...
You'll say it anyway.
It sure seems that way.
But it...
It certainly seems that way. It certainly seems very much like, well, we're having, that looks like a real conversation or a real discussion, but it's really just for show, or it's really just an act. And not that it's been scripted or anything, but like you said, you know, you get your time, I get my time, don't really point out the inadequacies of each other's arguments,
right,
or the false statements. We just kind of all go along with it, but it's one thing, like,
And as a result, it's just a smorgasbord of opinion. It's not any effort to think. It's not every, you know, on the panel on Fox News reports, Charles never says to the others, well, you know, that historically speaking, you're just full of hot air. This is just gas. He will occasionally, he's the best of all of them, but he will quite often say, well, I'm a psychiatrist, and when people behave the way Obama just behaved, they would consider it psychopathic. He will make comments, but he'll never say to Juan, you're being psychopathic yourself. And so, of course... We report, you decide. Well, there's no way to decide because you don't really know what you've just heard. Well, anyway, getting back to my, I want to focus on what the major battles in the war of ideas would be, and that illustrates that one of them is that the debates are phony and staged. They're not trying to come up with the truth. What are some other battles in the war of ideas?
Class warfare. All this class warfare conversation.
Okay, that's a good point. Rose said the two Americas. there's no question about this. This is a non-debate that is still a valid discussion in Europe, but we're in the new world. There is no class warfare in this country. It's all made up in the minds of liberals. Keep in mind that the origin of liberalism was the liberation from monarchy, the overthrow of aristocracy. And the way the aristocracy in Europe handled that was to simply take over liberalism and adopt it as their own. And so the aristocracy still exists in Europe. And there's still no capacity for the average ordinary peon to rise up into the high levels of European society. And as a result, when Arabs and others move into Europe and England, they aren't assimilated into the culture. They are a fourth-rate citizen. In this country, you can be an immigrant from Cuba, and 10 years later you can be Marco Rubio, senator from Florida. We have tremendous mobility. There is no class stratification in this country. There may be a few leftover remnants of it, but this is, as they say, a done issue. We've solved the issue. There are remnants, there are reminders, but it's only Democrats in their talking points that continues to pretend that there are two Americas. That's nonsense. Good. Anything else? Well, my definitions tend to be more at the abstract level. There's the battle between absolutism and relativism. There's, thanks to existentialism, there's a whole generation of non-thinkers who believes that, well, whatever they want to believe is fine with them. There are no absolute standards. And then there's a whole group of people, mostly Tea Party, who believe that there are first principles that guide our life. So there's this clash between the relativists and the absolutists. There's the clash between those people who think in zero-sum terms and constant expansion. The whole thing about the debt and deficit is that the people in Washington who are in the administration, Democrats, believe in zero-sum, so they can't figure out how to stimulate the economy. You got one or two capitalists in there. They don't have anybody in the economic team that is actually a capitalist. If they got one or two capitalists in there, a capitalist knows how to take nothing and expand it into something. So there's this battle between zero sum versus expansion. The whole concept of manifest destiny expressed the capitalist core of America. Then we get all teary-eyed about it and apologize for making something decent out of the country. It would be like criticizing Israel for having the audacity to go into Palestine and make it a productive, profitable place where the Arabs that lived there before were poverty-stricken. Now it's, you know, a green and growing place and a rich country. How dare they humiliate the Arabs that way. And then there's the battle between humanism and exceptionalism. Humanism believes that one can establish utopia on Earth. It hasn't worked yet, but just give us a few more tries and we'll tinker it together. Versus exceptionalism, where there's the assumption that life on Earth is imperfect, but we can make it better and better as we grow and become more talented and skilled. And then there's also the conflict between fatalism and responsibility. There's large numbers of people that basically give up in the face of their own self-created fate and say, well, there's nothing I can do about this. It's beyond my control. Life sucks. I can't do anything about it. And then on the other side, there's the
the people who believe in responsibility and take control of their law. Well, these are some of the basic conflicts in human thinking. How can we create concord out of conflict? In our political and our social discussions, how do we create concord out of conflict? Anybody?
By asking questions instead of making statements, judgmental statements, by asking questions designed to agree.
Well, isn't that a judgmental statement? I'm just teasing you, Betty. Yes, good. Asking questions. Never accepting assumptions. Who else?
Well, I mean, until people learn how to think.
Okay, but they think
they're going to be the two sides.
Right, but they think they know how to think.
But they don't.
I agree.
And so it's like beating your head against a brick wall.
Okay. Anybody else?
Get back.
I'm sorry?
Try to get facts.
What kind of facts?
Well, whatever the debate is, I mean, research it.
Okay. Well, educate yourself, sure. I would say that some of the ways we can create concord out of conflict is to learn to think from the apex, to understand the duality of the war of ideas, and that there's one camp at this point on the baseline and the other camp at the opposite, and look at it and learn to think from the apex. A second point is to learn to cultivate respect for anybody thinking, even if they're very immature about it. Now, if they're making no effort at all and they're just spouting opinion, then they don't deserve respect, except that they have the potential eventually to learn to think. So we have to respect opinions and different points of view. I think one of the keys here is learning not to use ideas as weapons, as weapon-grade thoughts. We want to learn to use ideas kindly and gently, not explosively.
In other words, to quote my husband, it's not what you say sometimes as much as the way you say it.
Well, that depends on, first and foremost, you want to have something valuable to say.
Right.
If you don't have anything valuable to say, you want to shut up and be silent. I'm not saying that to you, Betty. I'm saying that general.
Just in general.
Yeah. Silence is an underrated experiment. But,
Well, I like the first thing we said about asking questions, because if you really don't know something, not that you shouldn't say, you really maybe shouldn't say anything definitive, but rather ask the question.
Oh, sure. Exactly. And so this brings me to the next point, and that is to heal or overcome our passion to conquer other people. This is territorial instinct taken to the mental level, where we have to prove our opinion is superior to other opinions. Well, the moment you realize that all opinions suck, and your opinion is no better than the false opinion of the person you're talking to, you get a new sense of humility that you don't have to beat the other person over the head with your weapon. You can cultivate a certain, you can say, well, let's see what we can agree on and build a base on that rather than killing one another. That's our territorial instinct. So how should this be promoted in schools? Anybody? Well, my approach and the approach that I've based the structure of Walden Grove on is to, A, teach the real nature of thinking, which involves asking questions and so on. B, instilling the value of respect for other people, a respect for not just teachers, but a respect for fellow students. And C, breaking the bondage of right and wrong. Ideas are not right or wrong. Any idea can at times be right and at times be wrong. What we need to do is understand the truth underlying the idea, not color them with opinion, right or wrong. How do we establish peace in mass consciousness? Since this is, after all, the theme of this segment is the history of peace.
Well, we each need to be an outpost in our own life of peace.
Okay, the way I have it is becoming a lamp set on a lampstand, an outpost, radiating peace, becoming a peacemaker in our own life, and cultivating cultural values that prize clear thinking. Okay, any final comments on that topic? Well, it's time for recess, boys and girls. So go out and exercise your feet, and we'll resume at 3:30. That's 10 minutes.